So this is day three at the 58th New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our first period speaker is Brother David Stiles on Lessons from David's Life. The subtitle for today is You Can Pick Your Friends, But Not Your Family. This is the third talk in his series, and the introductory reading was 2 Samuel chapter 5. Brother David.
Thanks very much, Daryl. And good morning, everyone. How's everyone doing?
Good.
Good. Anyone get any sleep? I got some sleep. Just not enough sleep. But anyway, last night was really lovely, and absolute huge shout out to the Indian contingent. That was absolutely epic. And I thought I knew a lot more about India than I did. I realized I got some work to do. But that was a lot of fun. And it was informative and really lovely fellowship. So thank you. Today we're going to look at this issue of family. And how wonderful family is, sometimes. Yes. Mate, honestly. So sorry, I'm brutal.
Hello.
Want me to repeat everything I just said? No. Right. Evan and Josh, I think by the end of the week, are going to send me in for a brain scan. You can pick your friends, not your family. And this is a class on the sons of Zeruiah, David's three nephews. And they were quite the lads. And I think it's a timely topic because apparently last night a number of our young lads got up to a bit of mischief involving eggs in the girls' dorm. And lo and behold, it was the same four lads who I have seen before embroiled in mischief-making. So I looked at the four of them. I thought, I should line you guys up and say, here you go. Here are the sons of Zeruiah. Anyway, they're off in their class, and I'll see them later. But before we do that, I just wanted to revisit where I live, where we live, where we've come from, and that's this place called Amaranth, which is a township. This area that we live in, and I showed you the map, and you know how rural it is, and in the summertime, very nice and green. Anyway, it's the smallest county. Amaranth is part of Dufferin County. It's the smallest county in Ontario. And two of the townships are named after Protestant reformers, Martin Luther and Melanchthon. What was his first name? Ulrich Melanchthon? Anyway, he was one of obviously Luther was back in the 1500s. These are reformers from the 1500s. The surveyor was Catholic. And the land looked so miserable to him that he named it after the people he despised the most. And this Catholic surveyor despised the Protestant reformers, right? Now, this was 400 years after the Reformation, and this Catholic chap had a big fat hate on for the reformers. So there you go. It's a little bit of an insight into the state of religious affairs not that long ago. Anyway, our township is named Amaranth, which is pigweed. But is anyone aware of what language Amaranth comes from? Where did they get the word?
Germany.
No, it's Greek. It's Greek. In fact, it's a word in the New Testament. And it's a very important word in the New Testament. Amaranth literally means unfading. And the reason it's called unfading is that the blossoms that amaranth produces, if you pick them, don't fade. because the thing's already a miserable, desiccated mess, and they last forever. Actually, amaranth is a very important ornamental plant. So has anyone ever seen bleeding heart? Yeah, in the garden, you know, those long, ropey, red, crimson tassels that hang off this great, big, massive plant? That's amaranth. It's an ornamental variety of amaranth, and there's a number of ornamental varieties. But if you were to pick it, it would just stay the same because it doesn't, it's already, like I say, kind of desiccated. Anyway, the word amaranth appears in the epistles of Peter twice. So if, and you don't have to look this up, I'll read it for you. So the in 1 Peter 1 verse 3, it says, blessed be the God and Father of the Lord of Jesus Christ, who according to the great mercy of him has begotten us again to a hope, living through the resurrection of Jesus Christ and from the dead to an inheritance, right? Imperishable, aphartan, and undefiled, amianton, and unfading, amaranton. That's our word, amaranth. It means unfading, and it's used to describe the blessing we look forward to in the resurrection. We will become like pigweed, unfading. Emphasis on the unfading, not the pigweed. And it's also used in 1 Peter 5, verse 4, in a slightly different form, also to describe our inheritance in the Lord, unfading. So, hopefully that'll help you remember where I'm from for the rest of your lives, because I come from the land of the unfading plant, which I pull out of my garden every year in great abundance. Anyway, interesting fun fact. At least I thought it was a fun fact. Right, so on with our subject, you sons of Zeruiah. Now, there's just one little item I wanted to touch on about David, which I didn't reference, and I think it might be helpful to reference and to have a quick look at, because in 1 Samuel 27, verse 1, it says, but David thought to himself, one of these days I will be destroyed by the hand of Saul. The best thing I can do is to escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will give up searching for me anywhere in Israel, and I will slip out of his hand. And I always find that a very remarkable statement about David, because David had been promised the kingship. He had been anointed by Samuel, and the implication was God would preserve his life and that he would be king. Jonathan himself said to David, you will be king, and my father knows it. And yet at this point in time, David despairs of God's promise, right? He gets really discouraged. He leaves the land of Judah, which the prophet Gad had expressly said to not do, like stay in Judah, I will preserve your life. And I think it's, you know, encouraging, helpful, and, you know, definitely exhortative for all of us who have experienced moments of despair to recognize that frequently men and women that we read about in the Bible hit points in their lives where they question God's promise and his intent. You know, you think about Abraham, and when he said to, you know, both Pharaoh and Abimelech, Sarah is my sister, that's because he got afraid. He despaired a bit of God preserving his life. You know, Joseph, when he was stuck in prison, he asked the butler and the baker, or, well, the baker was dead. The butler was still alive. He asked the butler, please remember me. The man forgot him, despaired of ever getting out of prison. So, you know, godly men and women reach moments of despondency and despair. Does that mean we've failed miserably or, you know, we've done something unforgivable? Absolutely not. David went on to recover, to move forward. But there are points in time in our lives where we, share that moment, share that experience. And, you know, we look around us and, you know, we may have been stuck into conflicts and difficulties and struggles and, you know, confronted with the consequences of our own failures, or the failures of others, or our ecclesia, You know, how many times does the ecclesia turn into a source of some of our biggest stresses? And we really get quite down about it all. And we, you know, we wonder, and you know, what am I doing here? Is any of this worth it? Is there someplace else I'm going to find at least some temporary happiness? And, you know, those are real, you know, kind of epiphanal moments in our lives. And you look at guys like David, you got to remember, he went through the very same thing. And he hung on. He kind of clung with his fingernails. And, you know, powerful example to take note of. Anyway, on to these three chaps, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. A couple of you have commented that Joab is one of your favorite characters in the Bible. And I have to share that sentiment. He definitely is. Joab is a fascinating individual. And he represents a very kind of complex mix of good and bad. And, you know, here's Saul on the one hand, who just makes a consistent train wreck of everything that he does. He, you know, at least in respect to his relationship with God and his relationship to those around him, he just keeps going until, you know, he takes his own life on the mountains of Gilboa. David, on the other hand, consistently steers himself in the right direction, you know, maintains his relationship with God, maintains his relationship with those around him, becomes a force for good in a consistent, overarching sort of way throughout his life. So, you know, that's David's lane, here's Saul's lane. But there's this middle lane, and Joab occupies the middle lane and in a very interesting sort of way, and he makes a very interesting study. And, of course, Abishai is also a very interesting character, but, you know, I would suggest Abishai managed to shift his lane closer to David's than Joab did. So we have these three men. They are mentioned 24 times as the sons of Zeruiah. And it's their mother, David's sister. Like, I can't wait to meet Zeruiah. I mean, I got to imagine, she was one tough bird. She probably woke those three boys up every single morning, bright and early, rousted them out of bed, parked them in front of, you know, the breakfast table and said, right, what are you three about today? And it better not, you know, you better not cross my path. So she, you know, whether she was or whether she wasn't, the frequency with which she is mentioned, I would suggest, represents a formidable lady who was, you know, raised these three sons. Now, admittedly, she had mixed results, as we all do when it comes to our kids. You know, we love them dearly, always will, but let's face it, you know, we all have our moments. But she was, and I wonder if out of the family, maybe Zeruiah and David had forged a close relationship, because David had a big family, had a ton of nieces and nephews. And he did, in the end, his brothers and his other nephews were represented in his kingdom, in his court, in his administration. But I suspect these three were the closest, undoubtedly the closest. So it could well be that David and his sister, Zeruiah, had forged a close bond. I'd like to think so, because I don't think it was easy for David growing up, as we considered yesterday. All of them were bold, daring men of action. These guys were doers. They hated, you know, sitting around, not doing something. And it's interesting how that way of approaching life very often generates mixed results. And I think we can all appreciate that, you know, when we have individuals who we, you know, live life with, and they aren't happy unless they're doing. I often find them quite exhausting. And it, you know, because if you're not mounting a campaign or organizing a Bible school or, you know, getting on with some preaching activity or organizing a young people's thing, you know, it's like, well, I'm not doing enough. So, you know, and they're great to have. Like, let's face it. You know, you look at what we're enjoying this week. If it wasn't for the doers, where would we be? at the beach doing absolutely nothing. Enjoying the sun. No. We would have a far less profitable time. So these guys were doers, and they were prepared to expose themselves to danger to get things accomplished. One point, just stepping back a little bit, and I want to, put this out now. When you look at David's life, and you look at all the personalities that occupied David's life, that filled David's life, it is an absolute mixed bag of individuals. They represent the complete range of, spirituality, of good, of bad, of indifference, of wisdom, of foolishness, of kindness and cruelty. All of those characteristics, all of those personalities, all of those kinds of people are there the entire time, right? Now think about that. David was a good man. We know he was a good man. He was a man after God's own heart. David did not go through his life and clean house, right? He did not do that. He didn't go and like, hey, I don't like you. You're out. You're disfellowshipped. Hey, you over there. Yeah, you're a bit shady. Gone. Go. Immigrate someplace else. He didn't suppress, get rid of, or eliminate very many people at all. I mean, actually, it wasn't by David's hand that some of these individuals did get eliminated. David let it all play out, and he kind of left it. And I think, brethren and sisters, one of our huge challenges as disciples of Christ is, we somehow have it in our heads that if I don't keep a certain kind of company, I've failed my Lord in my service. If I don't somehow associate myself with, someone who talks like me, looks like me, acts like me, thinks like me, believes like me, I've done something wrong. That's certainly not the example we have set in the Bible at all. Nobody gets up and leaves because the chap next to them did something off. They're like, all right, your problem, not mine, mate. It's dealt with in certain ways. It's addressed. But the way it's addressed is not expulsion. So when you think about Saul, who did he have looking after his sheep? It was Doeg the Edomite. This guy was terrible. I mean, he ended up being a super evil dude. And David writes about him in the Psalms. Now, did David chase down Doeg and kill him? Well, we don't have any record of it. We kind of hope he left because he was so bad. But nonetheless, there was that kind of a person hanging around. He gets left. And I think, we often talk about the parable of the wheat and the tares. What did Jesus say? Don't pull the tares. What do? We go around and pull the tares. We're just looking for tares. Admittedly, in my garden, I pull weeds. And it's, gives me a great deal of satisfaction to get rid of something I think is evil. But it's funny how that feeds something in my soul, doesn't it? I clean it up. I have a clean garden, straight rows, beautiful veggies, tons to eat at the end of the year. That's because I get rid of what I deem to be evil weeds. But as a way of living life, it's not helpful. Not our job. And David, despite being a godly, righteous individual who set an example of right conduct most of the time and wanted the nation to serve the Lord with all their heart, all their soul, all their might, he wasn't cleaning house the way we might think he should have. And three of these individuals who were very close to them represented some problematic behavior. So when it comes to these three chaps, we know Asahel, unfortunately, didn't last very long because he was pursuing Abner and was desperate to engage him. And Abner said, don't chase me. I'll kill you. I can kill you, and I might have to. And lo and behold, Asahel ends up, a bit of a sticky end with the butt of a spear through his guts. So we don't know what Asahel would have become. That was his end. Abishai is a far more prominent figure in David's life. And Abishai was that kind of guy who was, you know, they were, and this, when we get into Joab, we're going to find how fiercely loyal they were. But I would suggest that Abishai is the kind of mate you love to have. He doesn't always say the most appropriate things, but his loyalty and his willingness to stand by you no matter what circumstance you find yourself in must have been, in some respect, encouraging and comforting to David. Abishai was just that kind of guy. And he very often put things out to David that were not appropriate. He was, you know, quite keen to finish off Saul. He just felt like this was a problem that needed to be fixed. David absolutely said no. What was David's attitude? The Lord's anointed. Saul is not mine to eliminate. That's God's choice, not mine. And that's one thing that is so amazing about David, is his willingness to respect the divine process. Abishai, on the other hand, was, you know, he liked the shortcuts. When Shimei came out and cursed David as he was fleeing Jerusalem, what did Abishai say? Famous line, "Let me go up and cut this dead dog's head off." That was Abishai. Dead dog. You're going to make him dead. And David said, nope, not right now, my friend. God has sent him to curse. I deserve everything he says. And David knew he did. He saved David's life in battle against the Philistines. He was one of David's mighty men. Abishai was a good guy. I like Abishai. And, you know, David had the ability to, you know, fend off Abishai's, you know, over-enthusiastic responses. Joab also, you know, brave man. And he took enormous risks to advance the cause of Israel and the people. And of course, one of the famous stories is David was looking for someone to be the captain of his army, and he kind of, whoever takes Jebus, Jerusalem, gives it to me, you'll be the captain of the army. Which is interesting that Joab didn't actually have that job. Apparently, no one did yet. David was looking for a man who would be suitable to the task. And as soon as those words got out of David's mouth, Joab goes for it. Has anyone had an opportunity to visit Jerusalem? You guys were there. Yeah, and how many did the tour of Hezekiah's conduit? And before you do the conduit, you remember how you looked down the old well shaft? Does anyone remember look down the old well shaft? Yeah. So if you ever get an opportunity to do it, it's so amazing. The very shaft that Joab climbed up is still there. They found it. And, a bit of rough shape. But it's quite a long climb, right? So at any moment, if somebody came and dropped a bucket down to get water and just happened to peer over the edge, there you were. There was Joab. And he would have ended up like Abimelech, big fat rock on his head. Anyway, Joab took the risk. He got up in there, you know, was able to open the city to David and his men. Took enormous risks. He was a courageous warrior. Very often in the face of overwhelming odds, in 2 Samuel 10, they engage the Ammonites, and they're almost overwhelmed. And Joab encourages everybody in the Lord at that moment in time. You read that event. Joab says the right things. The man was a believer. And this is, again, I find quite interesting when you look at the lives of these individuals. You look at Saul. Did Saul ever not believe God existed? Did Saul ever not believe God's word? And, you know, often we look at that and we say, right, you know, if I believe that God exists, if I believe in God's word, you know, I'm set, I'm good. And actually, that's just the first step in a long journey of spiritual renewal and growth. An awful lot of us get to that stage in life where we believe God exists, we believe his word, we believe God means what he says, and for whatever reason, it does not become an impetus to grow. That becomes a matter of choice. We must choose to grow. Saul didn't. Joab also believed, And he accepted the fact that God was with them and blessing them and encouraging them. But there were certain parts of Joab's life, as we know, that he kind of immune from godly influence. And we're going to look at that. So Joab, he was the dominant figure among the brothers. He was David's captain of the army for most of his reign. Now, when I was growing up, over and over again, I was told that, you know, Joab was, his general perception was he was self-serving. He was self-interested, that Abishai and Joab were unkind to David. They exploited him, intimidated him throughout his life. That they blackmailed David with the letter concerning Uriah's murder to extort favors. And I think I had it. Was that with you, Joanna? We had this conversation about Joab. That Joab was like a chieftain. Is that you? I think it was. Yes. Anyway, Joanna, who has an active mind and is always thinking, she's in vet school doing amazing, suggested that possibly Joab had carved out his own sphere of influence in Israel. I did disagree, but it was a very interesting conversation. And I just want you to know, Joe, I'm always open to a different perspective. However, I will not be sharing that perspective in this talk. Just, that's a disclaimer. At any rate, that isn't actually a completely uncommon perspective of Joab, that he kind of ruled the roost. He was the power behind the throne. He was manipulating David. Joab is portrayed very often in a very dark sort of way. I don't know. We'll find out, right? We'll find out. In the meantime, I get to say my piece. But there's a discussion forum, so, you know, we can have at it later on. So this is my suggestion. My suggestion is that Joab was a misguided zealot. He was zealous for the nation. He was zealous for his king. But his thinking, what motivated Joab, was far too often a fleshly chain of thought as opposed to a holy spiritual one. Joab was loyal to David through the hardest times of David's life when he was fleeing as a fugitive from Saul and Absalom. He was absolutely steadfast, and he certainly believed in God and recognized God as responsible for his victories, as we just referenced. And I think one of the most telling examples about Joab, this is something, I can't help but respect about the man. If you turn to 2 Samuel, and this incident with Absalom, that whole Absalom story, all of the events surrounding it are absolutely fascinating, because David, everyone knew what David had done in respect to Bathsheba. That was absolutely common knowledge. And we often wonder, how was it that Absalom was able to curry the favor of the nation? He seduced everybody, almost everybody. This is David we're talking. Everyone loved David. David was admired. He was the hero. He had slain Goliath. And yet there came a point in David's life when his appeal to the nation had faded so badly that this charming, good-looking, glib son was able to pull the rug right out from underneath him. And did David see it coming? I don't know. How could you not have seen it coming? David didn't, or he certainly, if he did, he didn't act on it. And in the end, he runs for his life with his loyal followers. Just an incredibly sad turn of events. And, God, what had God said? The sword won't depart from your home. This, again, could have been a moment in David's life where he experienced a period of despair, despondency, and resignation. My time's over. I've done this to myself. And certainly when David said to Abishai, God has told Shimei to curse. David's perspective in that moment in time was, look, this is happening to me for a reason, and I accept it, which is, again, reflective of just how profoundly connected David was to God. But, you know, they engage the battle, and the forces, David's forces, led by Joab and Abishai and Ittai, the Gittite, overwhelm the rest of the nation and the army that Absalom and Ahithophel had mounted. So in chapter 19, verse 1, Joab was told, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. Now, of course, what did Joab do? He killed Absalom. What did David say? Don't kill Absalom. As soon as Joab saw the opportunity to kill him, he said, remember what he did? He said to the soldier, didn't you kill him? Did I kill him? No. You know, king said, don't kill him. And besides, I know what you would do, Joab. If I killed him, you'd say to the king, this guy killed him. Actually, I don't think Joab would have. I think that guy miscalculated and thought Joab would turn him in. Joab was like, yeah, get out of my way. And Joab goes ahead and does it, which is also reflective of the state of affairs in Israel. Israel did not function in a totalitarian sort of way. The Jews have always been, you know, fiercely independent and autonomous people, and they are to this day, certainly reflected in the narrative. A bit amusing, really. The king is weeping and mourning for Absalom, and for the whole army, the victory that day was turned into mourning, because on that day the troops heard it said, the king is grieving for his son. The men stole into the city that day as men steal in who are ashamed when they flee from battle. David's reaction to it all affected them deeply. The king covered his face and cried aloud, oh, my son Absalom, Absalom, my son, my son. Then Joab went into the house to the king and said, today you have humiliated all your men who have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and concubines. You love those who hate you love those who hate you, and you hate those who love you. You have made it clear today that the commanders and their men mean nothing to you. I see that you would be pleased if Absalom were alive today and all of us were dead. Now go out and encourage your men. I swear by the Lord that if you don't go out, not a man will be left with you by nightfall. This will be worse for you than all the calamities that have come on you from your youth till now. Isn't that interesting? Joab referenced, he knows David's life intimately. He goes, David, you've not had an easy life, and I'm going to make it worse. Smarten up, my friend. Now, it was great advice. It was exactly what David needed to hear. You know what David did? Listened. And he got out, and he acted like a king, and he restored the men's spirits and acknowledged the fact that they had wrought a great victory. Now, you might say, oh, well, Joab got away with that because he had his letter in the pocket. You know, maybe he kind of started pulling it out a little bit, that letter, about putting Uriah in the forefront of the battle. Oh, David, see the letter? Are you going to listen to me? I don't accept that whatsoever. If you do, you know, you're absolutely entitled to that perspective. To Joab, this was a matter of national interest. David, you're king. Act like it. And this son of yours, yeah, you damn straight I killed him, because that's what he had coming. And I'd do it again. So you smarten up, my friend. Uncle Dave, cut it out. I think Joab was absolutely right and justified in doing what he did and saying what he said. It needed to be heard. Now, I don't know. I mean, have any of us had opportunity to play that role in someone's life? Maybe I have. I can't remember being so mean at any one point. I'm sure others do. But nonetheless, I find it a powerful exemplar of Joab's good traits. And, you know, he was not, you know, everyone else was, oh, the king, you know, he's sad, I'm sad. Joab recognized it was not the time to be, I don't know, what's the term today? Is this empathy, sympathy? Is it empathy, but he wasn't sympathetic? I get so confused.
Sympathetic. Empathetic is when you feel it.
Feel it.
Because you experienced it. Sympathy is when you are recognizing the pain.
Recognizing the pain. So did Joy have either?
Probably not.
I don't know. But, you know, it's, you know, we were singing the hymns, you know, love and peace and joy, you know, it's great. I love it. But not every circumstance in life today is going to allow us to express, you know, traits that we might think more worthy, you know, peace and love and joy and, you know, I love you. And I'm a hugger. Everyone knows I'm a hugger, right? And a kisser. You want to kiss Phil? Want a hug and a kiss? Yeah, I'm sure. Would I love life to be like that every single day? I would. But it can't be. It just can't. There is a time and place for all of us to play the role of Joab. And not to end up like Joab, but to be that person in someone's life. And, you know, it's not easy. There were an awful lot of good men in Israel, and only one was prepared to say what Joab said. And wow, did it need to be said. But again, you might find my perspective flawed. It's all right. So even though Joab acted on his own authority, he usually did what was beneficial for David and the nation. Now, in two instances, Joab really took matters into his own hand. And, you know, of all the things Joab did, you might flag these two as, you know what, Joab, you went too far. And that was when he murdered Abner right outside Hebron, which was a city of refuge, as revenge for the killing of his brother. And then later, he actually kills his own cousin, Amasa. Remember that? When Amasa was appointed by David to be the captain of the host. And David sent him out to squash this rebellion of Shebna. When Shebna led away the 10 tribes, it was another rebellion in David's reign. And Amasa didn't, get on it. It's kind of an interesting, real quick, how am I doing for time?
Yeah, you've done 35 minutes-ish.
Okay.
You deserve more.
Another 10 to go.
Yeah. Do I got 10 to go?
Yeah.
You guys are so good to me. Yeah. you could always tell me a little porky and just say, oh, you got 2 minutes, Dave, and shut me up. all right, so turn to, if you turn to 2 Samuel 20. So, you know, this is the Shibna, verse 20, chapter 20, verse 1, 2 Samuel. Now a troublemaker named Sheba, son of Bichri, a Benjamite, happened to be there. He sounded the trumpet and shouted, we have no share in David, no part in Jesse's son, every man to his tent. Israel, understandably coming from the tribe of Benjamin, harbored lots of resentment. So all the men of Israel deserted David. This is after the whole Absalom thing, another disaster. But the men of Judah stayed with their king. So then he goes, the king said to Amasa, some of the men of Judah, come to me within 3 days and be here yourself. Amasa didn't get on it. Took way too long. Finally, David said to Abishai, I notice how he's trying to ignore Joab because he's still mad at Joab for killing his son. He says to Abishai, now Sheba, son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. You get on it. So who's there listening to it all? Joab. So Joab's men and the Kerethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty warriors went out under the command of Abishai. Joab must have loved that, his younger brother taking charge. And they go after Sheba. When they were at the great rock of Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. Joab was wearing his military tunic. Strapped over it, his waist was a belt with a dagger. As he stepped forward, it dropped out of its sheath. Joab said to Amasa, how are you, my brother? Then Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. If I kiss you, I won't kill you. Amasa was not on his guard against the dagger in Joab's hand. Joab gave it to him. Yikes. Anyway, not a cool scene. That's what Joab did. And as it stood, Amasa had been on Absalom's side. Amasa had followed Absalom. What did Abner do? Abner had inflamed 7 years of civil war in his ill-fated attempt to support the house of Saul. I don't know. David wasn't prepared to get rid of them. That was David's mindset. You know, if they were prepared to change their ways, no worries. David would work with it. Joab, he was an intolerant guy. Did these men deserve what they got? Maybe. In a certain way of doing things, in a certain world? Yeah, sure. They would not have lived to tell their tales. David wasn't going to do that. Joab did. Now, one of the most remarkable events, I think, that really reflects well on Joab, obviously that situation didn't, was his desire to stop David from numbering the people. Does everyone remember Joab's role in that? When God moved David to number the people, what did Joab say?
No,
don't do it. He said, God give you ever so many more, but don't do this thing. Don't do it. Joab knew his law. Joab was informed. Joab read his Bible. He knew what was what. Certainly knew the rules. Don't do it, David. And what else did Joab do to invalidate the census? Yeah, which tribe did he not count? Benjamites. I mean, if you would think there was a tribe you wanted to include in an illegal census, it was Benjamin. I'm assuming Joab didn't have very good feelings towards the Benjamites. But he tried to invalidate the census by not numbering Benjamin. Now, I don't know about you, but you know what, Joab? You're right again. You're right. You're trying to give the king good advice. In this instance, David didn't listen because, of course, we know God was seeking occasion against the nation. So, you know, it was God's intent that he override, you know, Joab's advice and this numbering take place. And then we know what happened with the plague and whatnot, which interestingly resulted in David picking the threshing floor of Onan, the Jebusite, which was where the temple was built. So fascinating connection of events there. But the point is, Joab had a perspective that was loyal to the nation and loyal to the king. So, what does that say about Joab? And what is it, what are our takeaways from it? What can we learn from these men? What can we learn from the example of Joab? Okay, Joab saw the situation in terms of expediency. He saw things from a perspective, and this is where it gets, you know, a bit interesting. Joab was kind of, you know, you talk about a foot in two camps, right? Well, if you think of a line, and the one side of the line is a spiritual perspective, a godly view, an intent to, you know, do what is right and holy and compassionate and loving and forgiving. And on the other side is just get the job done and don't, you know, bore me with the details. Okay, Joab walked life on that line. He was not, you know, in a camp fully guided by what was right, but he was certainly, you know, governed in some instances by the will of God and divine intent, okay? He kind of he threaded that needle in his own way. And it on occasion it worked. On occasion, Joab was a force for good, but then he was also a force that was problematic and had bad consequences. It wasn't really what should have been done. So an example, who was instrumental in bringing Absalom back into the court? Joab was. Why? Why did Joab do that? You remember? Remember? David missed him. He saw that David missed him. He realized David missed him. Was David going to, of his own volition, bring Absalom back? No, he wasn't. Where was Absalom, by the way? Yeah, was it? That was Amnon, Gordon. Amnon, no.
In Jerusalem.
No, but in exile, where was Absalom? With his grandfather, the Maacah, the king of Geshur, up north. Very interesting. You know, do you realize the Geshurites weren't Israelites? They were kind of a pocket of, you know, Canaanites that somehow managed to accommodate, and David married, you know, the king's daughter. They must have, you know, have associated themselves with the hope of Israel, I'm assuming. That's where Absalom was. David wouldn't bring him back. So Joab sets David up, and he has that wise woman go and tell her story. Remember that? Worth a read. If you don't remember, look it up. Great story. Joab sets all that in motion because he feels that Absalom needs to be reconciled with his father, and basically, let's move on. Let's put this together, move on. It was a matter of expediency from a certain perspective. You know, hey, maybe it's the right stabilizing thing to do. Get the heir to the throne back. Get things sorted out. This is not good. Not good for David. Not good for the nation. Not a good look. You know, he's up there with his grandfather. Who knows what's going on up there? Joab saw things from a certain perspective. And it really came to bite him at the end when he supported Adonijah over Solomon. Because again, Adonijah was the heir. He was the next eldest son. Joab did things from a perspective of political expediency, from a certain point of view, like, you know what? I kind of like doing it this way. I think it's our best choice. Let's go for it. And, you know, my suggestion is that Joab's downfall, his ultimate spiritual failure, was his inability to establish right priorities. David did. David consistently, in an overarching sort of way, ended up on the right side of the line. He was prepared to do what was expedient rather than what was right and holy and true, regardless of what that might mean in terms of immediate consequences. So when he killed Abner and Amasa, he just thought, you know what, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it now. And it's one of those funny situations where a lot of Joab's choices and a lot of the things he set in motion and the things he affected in the kingdom in the short term might have seemed like a good idea. Some of his decisions were good ideas in the long term, like making David, you know, quit mourning about Absalom. Other things set in motion some long-term consequences. Joab, because of the way he viewed things, was insensitive to those long-term consequences. And one thing that I think, brothers and sisters, we can get into trouble with is recognizing that in terms of the lives we live, right, our long-term goal is to be with Jesus in the kingdom, right? That's the goal. That's what we look forward to. That, you know, end result needs to govern decisions we make. And I think we all agree that in order to facilitate short-term, you know, machinations of life, we make choices that aren't helpful. You know, we end up in Joab's position where we set aside our spiritual and, you know, moral and ethical values, right? We kind of compromise them a little bit to affect something that is in really short term. It affects the way this life is lived, but without a view to eternity. So we might think, you know, as, you know, ecclesial members, as brethren and sisters, as, you know, hey, how do we kind of affect, you know, the best possible result with this, that, or the other thing? We're prepared to impose things that aren't God's priorities. We make decisions based on, in the end, political expediency, the politics of our ecclesial life. It's not right. Doesn't help. It might move things forward in the short term, but it certainly doesn't benefit us eternally. It's what is eternal that matters and counts. Something running smoothly or well, or, you know, like, just do it. Just get on with it. Let's just do this, do this, do this, do this, and we'll have a nice, well-organized event. We'll all show up and go away happy. Or even if we go away unhappy, what does it matter? We pulled it off. You know, those kinds of mindsets, you know, in the end become an impediment to spiritual growth. And while on occasion, you know, something good might come of it, very often we diminish and we dull inside of ourselves spiritual priorities. And that was Joab. In the end, what was good and holy and spiritual and eternal and related to, you know, the return of the Lord Jesus and salvation, yeah, you know what? Sometimes and sometimes not. That can't be the way we live our lives. There are certain things we need to consistently adhere to. Whatever kind of disruption it may cause in the short term, that disruption is part of the process. We must prioritize what our Lord has called us to. And that's outlined very clearly in the Bible. And when you look at David's choices, that ultimately was his end goal, what he viewed, what he saw. He looked beyond the horizon at something greater than whatever circumstances he was enmeshed in at the moment. So those are my suggestions in respect to Joab. Hope you found them helpful, and I am more than happy to engage vigorous disagreement.